This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the November 8th, 2017 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. On the day before President Trump kicked off an 11-day swing through the capitals of America's Asia-Pacific allies, promoting a sale of U.S. weapons to Japan and elsewhere, he couldn't resist making another threat against North Korea, which he referred to as the problem, telling Fox News' Laura Ingraham that, quote, if we don't solve it, it's not going to be very pleasant for them. It's not going to be very pleasant for anybody, end quote. The peoples in both Koreas and their neighbor Japan are well aware how unpleasant U.S. military can be when it comes to unleashing weapons of mass destruction on those perceived as America's enemies. But real questions remain about the U.S. military's capability to defend itself when one of those enemies threatens to fight back and has the capability of doing so. In a past program, I suggested that the reason that the resident had not ordered U.S. forces to shoot down any of the ballistic missiles that North Korea had launched since the beginning of Trump's war of threats with Kim Jong-un was because of the likelihood they would miss their target. This would be a humiliation on the world stage that neither the resident nor the U.S. military could afford to let happen. That's also the conclusion of Phil Giraldi, a veteran of the CIA and a frequent guest on this program, who wrote 2 weeks ago that underlying the American citizenry's willingness to accept that the military establishment could encircle the globe with foreign bases to keep the world, quote unquote, safe is the assumption that the 48 states are invulnerable, isolated by broad oceans and friendly nations to the north and south, and protected, Giraldi goes on, from far distant threats by technology interceptor systems developed and maintained at enormous expense to intercept and shoot down incoming ballistic missiles launched by enemies overseas. In the recent speech relating to the North Korean threat, Giraldi notes, President Donald Trump boasted U.S. anti-missile defenses are 97% effective, meaning that they can intercept and destroy incoming projectiles 97 times out of 100. Trump was seeking to assure the public that whatever happens over in Korea, Giraldi wrote, it cannot have an undesirable outcome over here in the continental United States, nor apparently in Hawaii, Alaska, and overseas possessions like Guam, all of which are shielded under the anti-missile defense umbrella. Trump, wrote Giraldi, was undoubtedly referring to, even if he was ignorant of many of the specifics, the ground-based mid-course defense, GMD, installations in Alaska and Hawaii, which are part of the existing $330 billion missile defense system. It is certainly comforting to learn that the United States cannot be physically attacked with either nuclear or conventional weapons, no matter what our government asks, our government does overseas. But is it true, asked Giraldi? What if the countermeasures were somewhat closer to 0% effective? Would that change the thinking about going to war in Korea or about confronting Russia and Eastern Europe? That's what I'll be discussing with Phil Giraldi when I get him on the phone about 20 minutes past the hour, and stay tuned for that. War Secretary James Mattis was already in the region in advance of Trump's trip, repeating the same warnings about North Korea that he had given earlier, by adding that the threat of a nuclear missile attack by North Korea is accelerating. Speaking in Seoul with South Korea Defense Minister Song Yong-moo at his side, Mattis said that regardless of what the North might try, it is overmatched by the firepower and cohesiveness of the decades-old U.S.-South Korean alliance. I cannot imagine a condition under which the United States would accept North Korea as a nuclear power, he said. As could be expected, throughout his week-long Asia trip, which included stops in Thailand and the Philippines, Mattis paid lip service to diplomacy, saying it remains a preferred way to deal with the North. With that said, he added, make no mistake, any attack on the United States or our allies will be defeated, and any use of nuclear weapons by the North will be met with massive military response that is effective and overwhelming, end quote. Do you recall when the Bush administration first tried to link Saddam Hussein with al-Qaeda in 9/11 in order to find another justification besides the non-existent WMDs for the illegal invasion of Iraq? When it wasn't true and those in the White House knew it? Well, it's time we recall the efforts by the pro-Israel neocons of the Project for a New American Century, who orchestrated the invasion and who fabricated the phony evidence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction when the CIA was unable to do so. And why is it time to revisit those unaccounted for and uninvestigated crimes? Because they're at it again. 6 years after the assassination of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan by U.S. Navy SEALs, we are now being told that among the 470,000 documents recovered from his headquarters, there is evidence of collusion between al-Qaeda and Iran. Writing in Bloomberg News on Friday, Eli Lake, a reporter with a well-earned reputation as a pro-Israel insider, wrote that Ryan Trapani, a CIA spokesperson, had told him that, quote, documents collected during the bin Laden raid, which had been declassified, indicate Iran and al-Qaeda have an agreement to not target each other. The documents, wrote Lake, indicate bin Laden referred to Iran as the, quote, main artery for al-Qaeda to move funds, personnel, and communications. And according to the CIA spokesperson, the Obama administration had kept these communications classified. What jumped out at me was Lake's report that Thomas Joslin and Bill Roggio, founders and editors of something called the Long War Journal, were given early access to the latest bin Laden files this week by the CIA. They say the latest information shows two wary rivals willing to cooperate against America. They focus, notes Lake, on a 19-page document allegedly from a senior al-Qaeda operative that gives an early history of the relationship. It began on friendly terms in the late 1990s. They, meaning the Long War Journal's Joslin and Roggio, write that the author of the document, who is not named but appears to be well-connected, quote, explains that Iran offered some Saudi brothers in al-Qaeda everything they needed, including money, arms, and training in Hezbollah camps in Lebanon, in exchange for striking American interests in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, end quote. It's likely that none of you have heard of the Long War Journal, but it happens to be a project of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a successor organization to the Project for New American Century, the pro-Israel neocon tank, the think tank that gave us the Iraq War. The foundation was founded the day after 9/11 as another beltway front for Israel wrapped like PNAC in the Stars and Stripes. If you follow the mainstream media, like I do, including NPR, you'll have heard or seen its executive director, Mark Dubowitz, speak against the nuclear deal with Iran, negotiated by Secretary of State John Kerry and the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany. More recently, and none too subtly, he was urging Trump to demand more concessions from Iran before recertifying the agreement as Congress requires the president to do every 90 days. Why, it should be asked, did the CIA provide these newly declassified documents to the Long War Journal, an organ of a pro-Israel propaganda agency where both of its reporters also happen to be senior fellows? The answer may lie with the person who the resident appointed to head the CIA, not a qualified intelligence professional, but a former member of Congress named Mike Pompeo, with a professed affection for Israel and undisguised animus toward Iran. Just 2 weeks ago, by no coincidence, he was the featured speaker at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, where he attacked the Iran deal, and as the Times of Israel described it, Pompeo stressed that Trump wants to ensure the U.S. foe has no pathway to developing the bomb. The notion that the government would, quote, curtail Iranian adventurism or their terror threat or their malignant behavior has now, 2 years on, proven to be fundamentally false, said Pompeo, a former Republican congressman from Kansas, who keenly opposed the Seven-Nation Accord when it was reached, end quote. That's in the Times of Israel, which you can find online in English. Thus, while the U.S. is rattling its swords against North Korea, we may also be watching the beginnings of a countdown to a war with Iran. Washington and Israel's close allies in Saudi Arabia added fuel to that fire by accusing both Iran and Hezbollah of an act of war after a missile fired from besieged Yemen landed in the Saudi capital of Riyadh. Iran, the Saudis said, provided the missile, and Hezbollah, they say, fired it. The Saudis, of course, have been conducting a bloody war on Yemen that has taken the lives of thousands of its people and led to the world's worst cholera epidemic, and they've done it with weapons purchased from the U.S. and with intelligence by the U.S. Air Force. As President Roosevelt once said of Nicaraguan dictator Somoza, he may be an SOB, but he's our SOB. The U.S. has a stable of them across the globe. This past week has witnessed the 100th anniversary of two of the most significant events of the 20th century. The repercussions of both are still being felt today, but in vastly different ways. The first of them last week was the centenary of the Balfour Declaration, which marked issuing of a letter by Britain's Foreign Secretary, Lord Arthur Balfour, to Lord Walter Rothschild, a scion of the world's dominant banking family, in November 1917, in which the British government authorized the setting up of a national home for the Jewish people in predominantly Muslim Palestine, which was then part of the Ottoman Empire and fighting Britain on the side of the German Kaiser. The second anniversary observed yesterday marked 100 years since the beginning of the Russian Revolution. With Vladimir Putin nowhere in sight, Russian communists, now a distinct minority, were joined by left-wing activists from 88 countries in marching through central Moscow to commemorate the centenary of the overthrow of the Tsar, but it was a pale shadow of the grand Soviet demonstrations that had previously been held in Red Square, as much as Russia, now a nation of wealthy billionaire oligarchs, other than having an all-powerful leader at the top, bears little resemblance to the old Soviet Union. That both events took place in the same month and within days of each other was not, in my estimation, a coincidence, but explaining that would need to be a subject of another program, or two. What I will attempt to point out in brief was why Britain engaged with its European allies in a war with Germany that it was not winning, would think it was so important to offer to Britain's Zionists, a minority within the country's tiny Jewish community, as it was worldwide, a home in Palestine. The evidence points to a simple answer. It was payment to the Zionists for what the British believed was their role in getting President Wilson to break his pre-election promise to the American people not to join the war and then to enter it on the side of Britain, which, it was self-evident, would enable the British to win it. Playing the key role in the matter for the Zionists was Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. He was not only a close friend of Woodrow Wilson's, but the head of the American Zionist movement. The most common explanation for Britain's decision to set up Palestine as a Jewish homeland in face of an understandably hostile Arab resistance is that it was designed to serve Israel's interests in the region, but that comes apart when one examines British Foreign Office documents, particularly during the first 5 years of its mandate. From assuming responsibility for Palestine in the colonial sense, following the armistice to its hasty departure in 1948, Britain's experience in Palestine was nothing but a long headache. It had gotten so bad that by 1923, there was apparently a demand from within the British government that the Balfour Agreement be withdrawn. This led to a telling memorandum by Edward Cavendish, the Duke of Devonshire, who had succeeded Winston Churchill as the Secretary of State for the Colonies, which was quoted in Palestine Papers 1917-1922, Seas of Conflict by Doreen Ingrams, published in 1973. Hard to find. Note his careful choice of words. This is the Edward Cavendish, the Duke of Devonshire. British policy in Palestine during the past 5 years has been based upon the Balfour Declaration of November 1917. Briefly stated, the object of the declaration was to enlist the sympathies on the Allied side of influential Jews and Jewish organizations all over the world. It is arguable, he went on, as the negotiations with the Zionists, which had been in progress for many months before the declaration was actually published, did in fact have considerable effect in advancing the date in which the United States government intervened in the war. However that may be, it must always be remembered that the declaration was made at a time of extreme peril to the cause of the Allies. The Balfour Declaration was a war measure designed to secure tangible benefits which it was hoped could contribute to the ultimate victory of the Allies. These benefits, said the Duke of Devonshire, may or may not have been worth securing and may or may not have been actually secured. But the objections to going back on a promise made under such conditions are obvious. The Jews would naturally regard it as an act of baseness if, having appealed to them in our hour of peril, we were to throw them over when the danger was past, end quote. Those are the words of Edward Cavendish, the Duke of Devonshire, and His Majesty's Secretary of State for the Colonies in 1923. This was largely confirmed by Britain's second wartime Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, in his memoirs. Lloyd George made an additional point by noting that the German Kaiser was also attempting to gain Jewish support. It was believed, also he wrote, that such a declaration would have a potent influence upon world Jewry outside of Russia and secure for the Entente, that is the Allies, the aid of Jewish financial interest. In America, their aid in this respect would have a special value when the Allies had almost exhausted the gold and marketable securities available for American purchases. Such were the chief considerations which in 1917 impelled the British government towards making a contract with Jewry, end quote. And the rest is history, which we are still dealing with today. So it comes as no surprise that none of what I just read to you has or will be mentioned in the mainstream media's reporting on the Balfour Declaration's 100th birthday. That's because Israel's supporters are unusually effective in keeping what they don't want the public to know from the pages or airwaves of our national media. Another prime example of this occurred just 5 days ago when the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces, a tax-exempt American charity, held its annual West Coast fundraiser at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, hosted as usual by the Israeli-American media billionaire Haim Saban and his wife Cheryl, who are well known to have been among Hillary Clinton's major supporters. In a matter of just a few hours, the organization raised $53.8 million, just under $54 million, for the welfare of Israel's Army of Occupation. And as usual, after these dinners, other than a brief article in the Hollywood trade publication Variety, there was not a single word of the event in the national media. The top donation announced at the event, and the largest single gift in the Friends of Israel Defense Forces history, was $16.6 million from Oracle co-founder and CEO Larry Ellison. According to its press release, Ellison's $16.6 million donation, all tax exempt, will support the construction of well-being facilities on a new training campus for the Israel Defense Forces co-ed infantry units. One would think this fits the definition of news, but it is more likely that despite issuing a press release to cover their tail, the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces would prefer the public not know what certain members of their community are doing for the soldiers of another nation, while thousands of U.S. veterans, many suffering from PTSD, are homeless in America's streets and committing suicides in double digits every day of the year. It's something to think about, but only you who are listening to Takes on the World and who will listen online will even know about it. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.